A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Udo Lindbergh? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. And this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Peter Orner. He's written an extraordinary book, an unforgettable and important book. It's called Am I Alone Here? And it's a book, at first, if you look at it, you might be bewildered by what it is. It looks like a book of essays about books he likes. But it's not that. It's a book about reading and what it does to the spirit, to the soul, especially at times when we don't know how to answer the questions that our lives are presenting us with. So we look to books to offer ideas about how other people, people with an interest in telling a story, rather than an interest in solving a problem, how these people handle a divorce, a death, a loss. And this book, which is called Am I Alone Here?, is a sort of notebook about those moments when reading has come to the rescue. Now, I wanted to begin by asking you about the title because it came to me that it's what a teacher says in the face of a particularly uncooperative classroom. Suddenly, you're discussing a book or a poem and no one seems to be doing anything but looking out of the window, and you look at them all and you say, "Am I alone here?" It's a feeling of radical separation from others of your species. What is it for you?
It's a rhetorical question I am constantly asking myself. In the context you mentioned, I do teach, but also just on the street and you know, at home, I'm always feeling like I'm sort of at a loss and that maybe there's nobody else who feels that way, but it's also a way of reaching out because I think other people do feel alone here. And I think what books do for me and what reading has always done for me is it somehow makes me feel less alone.
You find the stories where something human has happened. You may not, in fact, in your 6 to 8 page chapters, spend more than a paragraph or two talking about the book. It's that you went somewhere with a wife who was falling apart, and this story also has one. Or a brother and sister are not getting along, and Saul Bellow wrote about such a thing. And so this is about the way in which something that in life can only be misery-provoking and abject and despair-rending in literature can be a source of perfection, and perfection, consolation.
And for me, that's the remarkable thing. And I think when I was having hard times in my life, and this is, you know, I don't know what to call this book, and no one's not quite sure what to call it. Is it a book of essays? Is it a memoir? Is it something in between or neither? I don't know. But all I know is that when I was having a tough time in my life, I was always reading at the same time, which is a weird thing, because why wasn't I dealing with whatever it was that I was dealing with? Hard things, deaths, you know, losses, you know, divorce. But that whole time I would read quietly, and I thought as a way of not dealing with what I was experiencing. Looking back, I think what I may have come up with is the fact that those stories, Saul Bellow's stories, Eudora Welty's story, or whoever, kind of pulled me through. And not in a cliche sense, right? I mean, I don't know how to not make it sound like cliche that books saved my life, but I think books and stories allowed me to escape on the one hand, but also to engage at the same time.
Well, let's sit there in the subtitle, Notes on Living to Read and Reading to Live. Some people look at self-help books, but for people like us, those don't work. The language in which they're couched is too...
There's no self-help there. There's no... Because I think probably because they have easy answers, right? I mean, don't they... You know, here's what to do. What a story does is it gives you no guidance except how to sort of... except how not... Almost not to do things in a way. But it there's something about a story that by not providing a sort of guidepost into life helps me.
Well, one of the things that you did for me... I don't know if you know you did it, but you defined the Chekhov effect for me. You are reading Chekhov in a hospital cafeteria, and over here there are some doctors, women, gossiping about the male doctors, and over there there are patients having trouble eating this or that, and over there still there are orderlies, what have you. All of life is going on at the same time, and it happens as you look across the room. And that's the Chekhov effect, that nothing happens in an orderly fashion. It happens in a cheek-by-jowl, one thing next to another fashion, so that the stories, in a sense, however short they may be, overwhelm us by being, in a sense, about the possibility of everything.
And why, I think, and I've thought a lot about this, and I'll never come to an answer that will ever satisfy me, but why are Chekhov stories so successful? And that is because he wasn't really, you know, so much of fiction disappoints me because it seems to be going from point A to point B to point C. You never get that feeling in Chekhov. And I don't get that feeling existing in life that there is a point A to point B to point C. And I feel like he, by pulling in strands, I mean, he had to do it artfully, right? Because he couldn't film or tape record how it actually was. So he somehow replicates what life is like artfully, which is the amazing thing. But he didn't, he's not directing me how to feel.
Yes, I'm talking to Peter Orner about his book. We don't know what to call it. A collection, a gathering, a book of notes called Am I Alone Here? And it's a book by a man who has turned to the reading of stories and the writing of stories when human circumstances have seemed insoluble, inadequate, sad. So, you know how your teachers have always told you that reading is important? Well, if you read the stories that just get mentioned, this isn't literary criticism, this isn't fancy, this isn't hard to understand. It's a list of stories that will take you to the unfamiliar, unfathomable places where you get brought to a certain point and left there to figure things out for yourself. Now, this is very good because, after all, you're not suffering from the problems in the story. You're just left at the edge of the cliff. You don't have to jump. You can turn back and go home. But fiction has taken you there to see that maybe, maybe you would survive.
You know, when you read, what is it about you that, you know, I was on the plane today and I was reading Sebald. You know, and just because I needed some Sebald, right? And on the plane, and the guy next to me was talking, it was just before we took off, and he was talking on his phone, and I was just trying to concentrate. I wanted to be left alone. And I was, Sebald is at Bonaparte's house on Corsica, his birthplace, I believe. And the ticket lady in the story, in the essay, whatever it is, I love Sebald because you don't know what can I say, hell, what the hell it is. He thinks that the ticket lady looks like Bonaparte, like Napoleon, the ticket lady. And it's a tiny little line, but I was sitting there on the plane and I was right there with a dead writer and probably a dead ticket taker. And I don't know, there's something about, and yet I was with my people and I was annoyed at the guy next to me, but there was something about that that made me even like the guy on the phone for a half a second.
Yeah, we were fortunate or unfortunate enough to conduct one of the very last interviews with Sebald, the great German writer who left Germany, who said that everything great in Germany, he believed, had left Germany via a smokestack or over the border, that nothing remained, at least as far as he was concerned. And I asked him about a kind of fiction writing that I'd been told existed in Germany called Das Glück im Winkel, which means...
Das Glück im Winkel.
Yes. Happiness in a corner. A happiness so tiny that if you would leave the corner, it would disappear. And this is the kind of happiness that another writer you write about, a writer that Kafka liked a lot, Robert Walser.
Walser, of course.
Provides. Yeah. He spent a good part of his life in an insane asylum, but I think it was because he was able to capture so many vibrant aspects of happiness in a corner.
That's a beautiful phrase and beautiful idea, and I think that especially with Walser, who I've thought a lot about and is nicely having a nice renaissance of late, but I think that, you know, you say Walser was in an insane asylum, and he was. I think Walser's ability to capture the happiness in the corner is like almost nobody else. And I remember reading him, and in the essay in the book, I'm walking down the street and I watch this fish. I was in front of a fish store in San Francisco, and the fish escapes from the truck, and they're trying to get the fish into the tank, into the store, and one fish escapes, and he's on Mission Street in San Francisco. He gets run over. The fish gets run over, and I'm watching that happen while at the same time reading Walser while walking down the street in the morning. I don't know if that made any sense, but basically I'm always reading, so then I'm looking at something that's happening in the world. And I think Walser would have appreciated that moment. And I'm always, what Walser teaches me is you just got to be always watching, always, always watching.
What I love that you did was that you quote a Walser piece. Which one is it? Do you remember?
It's Kleist and Thun.
And he's imagining Walser, the Austrian writer Robert Walser, is imagining another writer, also a writer that we've often forgotten, a great, 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 great writer named Heinrich von Kleist.
Yes.
He's describing a day for Kleist, phrase by phrase, and capturing such oddities, such beautiful transparencies of the ecstatic spirit. Someone who, looking around in a 360-degree circle, is being made ecstatic by everything seen.
Happiness in the corner everywhere for Kleist. And Kleist, we should mention, is a writer who ended up, unfortunately, committing suicide.
Yes, and writing one of the most famous suicide-packed letters that you could ever read. Sometimes our writers, even the ones we love the most, are the ones who find it hardest to live. Tell us about Kawabata.
I mean, I don't think there's any necessary correlation between, I know they've done studies about this, artists and depression. I think that people are depressed and artists are people, and therefore they get depressed too. But I do think that I was interested in this book in writers who, I just love this idea of happiness in the corner, who kept finding happiness in the corner and looking for it. But at a certain point in their own lives, things got too heavy, as they do for everybody, not just writers, right? And so years ago, I came across this anecdote about Kawabata, where he took his most famous novel, one of his most famous novels called Snow Country.
This is a Japanese writer who won the Nobel Prize. And what does he do with Snow Country, his most famous novel?
And this is, I believe, a few months before his suicide. He took Snow Country and he wrote it again by hand into a very short 7-page story, mostly using the early parts of the novel.
Called Gleanings.
Gleanings.
Gleanings from Snow Country.
And I gleaned from an introduction of his work, and I was just curious about it because I love the novel Snow Country so much. And I mean, often in this book and in my life, I'm trying to imagine what makes people do what they do and write what they write. And so I was just thinking about what made Kawabata want to return after decades to the story of these two lovers in a mountain town in the mountains of Japan in the snow. And I was trying to figure out why he was going back there. And I was just thinking that maybe there was something in Kawabata's own life that made him want to return to those two characters, those two fictional characters that he made. But, I don't know if you feel this way sometimes, but I do, that the characters I create, they become so distant from me that they're no longer mine. So I think he actually wanted to revisit them as if they weren't his. And he rewrote the story in a way that made it possible to happen again in a perhaps a different way. That's my argument, is I argue that the reason that he wrote the novel into a 7-page story is that he wanted to see what it was like to experience the beginning of a love affair again.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Peter Orner about his book, Am I Alone Here? Notes on Living to Read and Reading to Live. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Peter Orner about his latest book, Am I Alone Here? Essentially a love letter to literature and its power over the story of his life. I want to tell my listeners, my beloved assistant, David, is a reader, but he's not a literary intellectual.
Thank God.
Most people aren't, yes. And he picked up this book and started reading it, and he loved it. Not because it talked to him about things he'd already read, but because it talked to him about things he might one day read. This book in particular comes at a moment in its author, Peter Orner's life. He was having trouble writing. His father had just died. This is a twin event, like a pair of salt and pepper shakers. The other event was a marriage had ended. And between the ending of the marriage and the death of the father, these are things that happen to everyone, not just writers. He read books, sometimes reread books, sometimes read short stories until he knew them by heart. So what's it like to carry someone else's story inside you, Peter?
You know, I'm a fiction writer, right? And that's what I love. And I read some nonfiction. I appreciate nonfiction. But what I crave all the time is fiction. And sometimes I write it. It's my vocation. It's what I do. It's what I love to do. And I found, you know, like you said, that I was having trouble writing after my dad died. What I mean by that is I was having trouble inventing fictional people doing stuff, because maybe for the first time in a long time, and my family would laugh at this, they would think I was thinking, I was going to say for the first time in a long time, I was thinking about myself. My family would laugh and say that is a total joke. However, to my credit, when I'm alone in my garage, basement office, I am exclusively trying to think about other people and invent other people, to do what Eudora Welty said was the greatest thing that a writer could do, which is to try and put yourself in somebody else's life, shoes, whatever. And I found I couldn't do that after my dad died.
So this is, for a writer,
it was devastating.
An identity crisis.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, how or did reading jumpstart your writing again? Well, it did. Well, these little essays. You started to write a column.
So I'd be in the basement, and I'd, you know, every morning I still do this, and even though I'm back to doing what I do, and as I say in the book, I mean, fiction is my day in day. My day job, no matter how little it often pays, it's still my day job. It's what I do. It's how I make my living. And but I think what these essays grew out of was they were an attempt to just sort of talk back to the reading that I'd done that morning. You know, every morning I read usually a short story, often a poem or two, chapter from a novel that I'm reading. And I would then take just a sheet of paper, in my notebook and writing by hand, I would just sort of respond to it a little bit. And, you know, it was a form of like personal literary criticism, not literary criticism in quotes, but I wanted to talk back to these stories in some way and you know, relate them back to a little bit of my own life and to discuss them in some way.
Peter Orner's books, which include a book of stories, not surprisingly called The Esther Stories, a couple of novels. They really want to talk about what it's like to be human, and also in ways that are not much less certain about this, but what it's like to be dear, to be dearly human, in the sense of dearly beloved. I think that if you look at Am I Alone Here, this new book by Peter Orner, published by a new, brand new publisher, Catapult, you'll be feeling what it's like to be dearly human. Now, you see that one of the problems that writers have in the world is that they want to be too dear. You almost say, as you read him, who could possibly not love Peter Orner? And we all know that these people...
Oh, no.
Yes, right. These people who won't let you not love them, they're very difficult people. Well, writers...
Horrible people.
They're difficult. Writers are difficult people.
Yeah, you really don't want to get close to a writer in any way. And stories are imperfect, and my hope is that this book isn't too dear and is imperfect in the way that the stories that I love are imperfect. You know, one of the writers I love dearly, and you mentioned her already, Eudora Welty, who, and I won't get on my soapbox about Welty, but it always bugs me a little bit that people think that she's a little old lady on her porch in Jackson, Mississippi, you know, being all genteel, right? That's not having read Welty ever, because she is deadly and mean and gossipy.
You call her a badass.
Oh, she's a badass. Eudora Welty's a badass. And I just feel like if you just read these people, and you can kind of just see all their imperfections, all their flaws are mirroring our flaws, and I think you can get through life a little better. I guess that's what it comes down to.
By the time you've finished reading Am I Alone Here, it's not just that you know a lot about the stories that Peter writes about. You know a lot about Peter. It's sort of an amazing concept that the books you read are the diary of your life. There's your life, and then there's the diary of your life. And the diary of your life is made up, is comprised of the books you read, the things that you've felt that have not been part of your life experience, but of your imagination's experience.
Don't you feel that, isn't it a weird thing that when you read something and you identified in such a strong way, it did happen to you, right? I mean, truly.
Well, it did happen
yeah.
to you. It happened, in fact, more than to you. It happened inside you.
I think in the, not every time, right? Not even nearly close to every time, but
when
in those times.
The story is at its best and you're at your best.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's rare that those two coincide. Huh? You're not always a good reader and it's not always a good story.
And I'm just getting this from you because I feel like, you know, I think the last person to understand what I've done is myself, but I feel like if it's working, there's a sense of when you do connect to a story and you are able to inarticulately discuss it, then you might actually end up finding out something about yourself you may not have known. And I suppose that's what it comes down to in what I was trying to do, or at least what I've now feeling like maybe I've almost done.
I've been talking with Peter Orner, author of Am I Alone Here? Notes on Living to Read and Reading to Live, published by Catapult. Thank you for joining me, Peter.
Thank you so much for your kind words on the book. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Am I Alone Here at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard has taken that role today. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. Baby this, baby this, baby this, baby this.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Mitch Siskind is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.